supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
I'm Dan Gottlieb. Thanks for listening to Voices in the Family. You know, if you Google the word happiness, you'll get hundreds, if not thousands, of book titles on the subject. Everyone is trying to tell us how to be happy and how we should be happy. But, you know, on one hand, you might think we don't need all those books. It's more pop psychology, jetsam and flotsam. Just leave us alone. We'll be fine. Happiness is natural state of being. Yes? Well, maybe not. In fact, it could be argued that happiness is not a natural state, that our brains are not wired for happiness, but for something that feels quite the opposite. But keep hope alive, because we're about to find out how to tap into a happier state of being. My guest today is neuropsychologist Rick Hansen. He's the international best-selling author of Buddha's Brain, and his new book is called Hardwiring Happiness, The New Brain Science of Contentment, Calm, and Confidence. He joins me by phone. Rick, welcome to the show.
Dan, it's an honor to be here.
Oh, thank you. And we're going to be taking your calls at 888-477-9499. Again, that's 888-477-9499. What's your baseline? Do you tend to see things more on the negative side or on the positive side? And do you have hope that your brain could be rewired? Rick, one of the basic premises of your book is that our brains are like Velcro for negative emotions and Teflon for positive. So happiness is not our natural state of being. Tell us about how that works and why.
Sure. Scientists call it the negativity bias of the brain. It's the idea that as our ancestors evolved, they needed to pay special attention to lethal threats because those had more urgency and impact than various opportunities. I mean, it's important to get food and shelter and so-called mating opportunities, but those tend to be manageable. If you don't get one today, you'll probably have a chance of one tomorrow. But if you don't avoid that, let's say, hungry lion or lethal aggression inside your primate band or between bands, then you've got no more opportunities for rewards forever. So in many ways, what the brain does is continually scan for negative information, then hyper-focus upon it, react to it intensely, and store that whole cascade in implicit memory, emotional memory for the lived residues of experience, including our attitudes or assumptions or expectations and kind of the inner mood or atmosphere of the mind.
So it does.
That's why.
Go on.
Okay, I'll just wrap it up then. That's why negative information about other people is more memorable than positive information, which drives, of course, negative campaigning and politics. We tend to need at least a 5-to-1 ratio. You're familiar with the John Gottman finding about long, strong relationships need that 5-to-1 ratio of positive to negative interactions. In effect, one negative neutralizes 5 positive. Barbara Fredrickson's work on thriving shows that it's really only when people get above about a 3-to-1 ratio of positive moments to negative ones that their life really begins to take off.
And your argument is that they are all out there. But, you know, to really underscore what you're saying is that, you know, I tell people you can be having a great day, the weather's good, you can feel healthy, but if you've got a cavity, how many times are you going to stick your tongue in that damn cavity during the day? I mean, you know, logically, it's crazy. But, you know, it's just to remind yourself that you're in pain. But
yeah.
I want to add something else. You know, there were the mountain lions out there in the past, and there's very few lethal risks out here today. But, you know, you watch TV or read the Internet, and all they pump into your brain 24 hours a day is catastrophe and catastrophe. Mm-hmm. So that's got to reinforce our fear and anxiety.
That's right. We, in the developed world, most people, not everyone, unfortunately, of course, but most people and many people in the developing part of the world don't have to, you know, run in screaming terror every day from, let's say, a charging lion or the equivalent. But just as you say, we're exposed to many mild to moderate chronic stressors that take us into what I call the red zone or the reactive mode of the brain, where it's fight or flight, and reactivity was useful for raw survival, you know, millions of years ago. But today, when most people live relatively longer lives, the short-term benefits of that stress reactivity are currently outweighed increasingly by the costs. And I think one of those key costs is that this bias in the brain creates a kind of bottleneck that makes it hard to transfer positive experiences in everyday life into long-term storage. So they become actually the traits, as it were, the enduring qualities woven into the fabric of our brain and our being.
Mm.
Unfortunately, though, positive experiences are actually the primary source of inner strengths, broadly defined, like resilience or happiness, positive mood, confidence, feeling loved, the character virtues, and so forth. And so what has gotten me very interested is the second phase of learning. As you know, as a psychologist, it's a two-step process, activation to installation. Psychologists, myself included, and teachers of various kinds, we're good at the activation phase. We can get a good mental state going, you know, even a mild one. But I don't think we've put enough attention on the installation phase, the conversion of this momentary mental state into a lasting neural trait.
For example, let's translate that. For example.
You mean offer an example? Yeah. For example, as people go through their day, studies show that many people have many momentary experiences that are positive. They get something done, or there's a nice conversation with someone, or they feel warm toward a friend, or they recognize some good quality in themselves. They see something beautiful in the world. They'll have a positive experience. But how often will we take the extra 10 or 20 seconds to transfer that positive experience out of short-term memory buffers into long-term emotional memory storage? So we take it with us. We don't do that very much, do we?
I see that in my office almost every day, where someone comes in and experience themselves in their lives as depressed, or say they're having a bad day, and during the sessions there is inevitably tenderness, intimacy, there's laughter. I watch their shoulders drop. I watch them smile, but they're not aware that this is happening until, you know, I come in on the end of the session and I might say, how was the session for you? And they might say, well, it was difficult or it was painful. And they just don't notice it. So now I get them in the habit of noticing it when it's happening. But
yes, I think you like many therapists and people in general are naturally fostering this installation phase. You know, I call it enriching and absorbing, you know, where you're transferring this experience into becoming something lasting in a context in which negative experiences get transferred immediately to storage. You know, they go right in. But unless we do this enriching and absorbing process, these positive experiences flow through the brain like water through a sieve.
If you're just tuning in, we're talking with neuropsychologist Rick Hansen about his most recent book, Hardwiring Happiness. Our phone number is 888-477-9499. That's 888-477-9499. If you feel like you are low on happiness, as I say, sometimes I wake up in the morning and feel like I'm a quart low on serotonin. But, you know, if your life feels like it's more gray than others, give us a call, 888-477-9499. Rick, I want to talk about how this whole thing got started. You know, psychological therapy really got started with Papa Freud, and he focused exclusively on what was wrong. And all therapies for the next 75 years have done the same thing, and medicine for centuries. has focused on what's wrong, and we just assume, understandably, that if we fix what's wrong, we'll do better. And, of course, then there's that Seligman guy who wrote mm-hmm. talked about learned optimism. So, I mean, we come right. by this honestly. Our instinct is when something's causing us pain, we focus on the pain.
Right. Obviously, there's a place for facing pain directly, grieving losses. I think that it's not useful to, how can I put it? You know, people talk about, being optimistic or pessimistic. I think what's really important is to be realistic, you know, is to see the whole mosaic of life while recognizing that the Stone Age brain tends to hyper-focus on the negatives. But as you know, during the 50s and 60s, especially with people like Rogers and Maslow, there was more and more of a focus on inner strengths of various kinds, which is what I really mean broadly by happiness. When I talk about hardwiring happiness, I'm talking about wiring resilience, well-being, eudaimonia, you know, a sense of fulfillment in life, character virtues, for example, the 24 character strengths that Seligman has pointed out, as you just mentioned a moment ago, and how to actually get those into us. And when we broaden the notion of happiness to include inner strengths broadly, including resilience, executive functions, secure attachment, and all the rest of that, when we think of it like that, then we realize, whoa, the real question then becomes, how do I get that into my brain? And, you know, that's what I've gotten very interested in.
Yeah, well, we should say in all honesty, it's not how you get that in your brain. It's already in there, but how do we nurture it?
Sure, and also how do we learn? You know, how do we learn from moments of accomplishment that we're actually more capable than we've thought? How do we learn from moments where we experience a little relaxation or a sense of inner strength that we don't need to be so anxious as we've been? Or how do we learn from moments of recognizing good qualities in our own heart that we don't need to beat ourselves up as badly as we have? I mean, to me, that's the opportunity, you know, to steepen the learning curve in life 10, 20, 30 seconds at a time, at least a few times a day.
You're really talking about how the mind can modify the brain.
Exactly right. You know, one of the things that's, as you, again, very much well know, you know, the evidence for how the mind, our thoughts, our feelings, what we put attention on and what we do with what we attend to, is continually sculpting the brain, you know, the territory of experience-dependent neuroplasticity, for better or worse. And for me, part of what interests me here is, what is the essence of self-reliance? You know, if we have a brain that is designed to continually change its structure, to learn from experiences, who's taking charge of that structure-building process, right? The forces outside us, or the voices still in our head from our childhood or our first job or marriage, what have you, that biases and tendencies of the Stone Age brain, or are we taking more charge of the ongoing structure-building processes of our own brain from the inside out?
All right. I'm listening to you carefully, and I'm having a complete meltdown here as I just feel my identity just got shattered. So if we've got a mind that's modifying our brain, mm-hmm. who the hell am I? I mean, where's the me in all this?
Well, this is a very deep matter, and, you know, I have some background in Eastern psychology, and as you know, in the Eastern traditions, they consider the self to be much more of a kind of distributed process mm-hmm. than the conventional Western psychological notion of this kind of entity, you know, looking out through the eyes. And it is shocking, Dan, actually, to look at MRI scans of the brain doing various tasks that seem related to me, myself, and I. And what you see is that there's no place in the brain that does the sense of self.
Right.
It's widely distributed.
Yeah, I mean, I love who brought this thinking into Western culture first. I think it was Eckhart Tolle, you know, talked about the how we get in so much trouble with our ego, how,
yeah.
you know, it just brings us great pain.
For me, a helpful distinction, and we're definitely going into the deep end of the pool with this, it's a distinction between the person and the self. In other words, clearly, there are persons. You're a person, I'm a person. persons have moral rights, they have moral duties, they change and they grow over time. We can be kind to persons, and we could be kind to the person that we are without necessarily taking life so personally.
Yeah, exactly. Let's go to the phones, Rick. We've got some callers and want to join the conversation.
Great.
We'll start with Alice. Hi, Alice.
Hi.
Hey.
Yes, I'm with the Granny Peace Brigade Philadelphia. And basically, I'm an optimist, but I've also been involved in civil rights. And right now I'm concerned, and we are concerned about the drones and the killing of innocent people. So, you know, am I feeding into negative, or is there a time for that?
Yeah, don't go anywhere, Alice, because when we're done chatting with you, I want to hear about the Granny Peace Brigade. So, Rick?
My take on that is, I'm with you, Alice, about wanting to see the hard things, the bad things, the challenges ranging from, obviously, out there in the world in a political or cultural economic frame, and also in our own homes, you know, in our relationships, in our own self, you know. That part's really, really, really important. And I think that there's a place for recognizing what's negative, facing it squarely, and then also there's a place for building up resources inside ourselves for dealing with the negative. So how do we, for example, sustain peace work or social justice work or just get through a long day, you know, with a not the world's greatest job maybe, and we've got kids at home, an aging parent, whatever, you know, real life or health issues and so forth. How do we grow resources inside ourselves so that we can cope more effectively, be more resilient, and not experience, you know, compassion fatigue, caregiver burnout, et cetera,
all right,
et cetera.
Rick, stop asking all those questions. Let's get some
answers
here.
Start answering them, right? That's right.
Yeah.
So for me, that's the answer then is to look for those opportunities, 5 or 10 or 20 seconds at a time, half a dozen times a day, you know, in the ordinary flow of life when we're usually just naturally already experiencing something positive. It's typically mild. On the 0 to 10 intensity scale, I'm talking about the 1s and 2s mostly of everyday life. But in that moment, when you, in terms of peace work, let's say, have a sense of camaraderie with others or a sense of some kind of progress or accomplishment, even in a very imperfect world, to really let that register and sink in, not to delude ourselves about what's still challenging, if not horrifying, out there in the world, but to actually gird our loins, you know, using that old phrase, so that we can fight the good fight without, you know, getting fried in the process.
Alice, tell us a little bit about the Granny Peace Brigade.
Well, the Granny Peace Brigade encourage people. We send out leafletting, but we encourage people, like, for example, to go to Horsham, where there may be a command center for the drones being built, and we would like people to be out there and join us and join the peace community that we can reverse the war mentality and the war dollars that are spent. And it's just an overwhelming challenge. And, you know, how do you talk about the dark side,
yeah,
what we're talking about is being positive, but I'm just thinking, how do we see that there's a granny my age was killed by a drone, you know?
Right. Well, I appreciate your call, and I hate to oversimplify what this brilliant neuropsychologist said, but, you know, the feeling I get, and I'm going to turn to you, Rick, is, you know, the song, Let There Be Peace on Earth, and let it begin with me. And we have to operate from, do whatever we can to nurture our own compassion and kindness.
Well, I would agree with you, Dan, and I don't know if I'm brilliant, but I appreciate that. I'll try to take that in myself.
As soon as your title has a neuro in there, you're way out of my league.
I don't know, but anyway, I think what I would say is, I often, I'm old enough now, having grown up in the 60s and 70s, that I think there are a lot of false dichotomies between inner work and outer work, or, taking in the good and also seeing the bad. And paradoxically, through deeply internalizing and inner strengths, you know, through mining, harvesting, I think of it, as the fruits that are available to us a handful of times every day in everyday life, by weaving those strengths into ourselves and gradually growing psychologically in efficient and in targeted ways, we actually become more able to sustain compassion for others. It's not either or. As our own cup runneth over, we then have more and more that we can give to other people.
Well, let me just comment on this before we take our 60-second break. Kristen Neff, studies self-compassion and writes about it. And in her research, she finds that people who are not compassionate with themselves and say they're compassionate with others are actually less compassionate than they think they are, and that people who do feel self-compassion are more compassionate with others. So you're right.
It's exactly right.
It's a false dichotomy. So let's take a short break, and we'll be back with more of Rick Hansen. So much more to talk about how to rewire our brain. His book is called Hardwiring Happiness, The New Brain Science of Contentment, Calm, and Confidence. And we are at 888-477-9499. We have just a couple of lines open. So if you want to call, give us a call at 888-477-9499. Well, I'm Dan Gottlieb. You're listening to Voices in the Family. It's right here on WHYY-FM. We are back on Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb, your host. We're talking with neuropsychologist Rick Hansen about hardwiring happiness. Rick, this emotion of fear is very powerful. And I see people in my office every day where fear is in the driver's seat. It's like people who are in pain, physical or emotional, that's in the driver's seat. I tell many of my patients that they worship at the altar of fear.
I think that's so deeply true. And as you know, in the book, I go through how the brain evolved in terms of what the implications are, practically speaking, for us today. You know, as the brain moved through its reptilian, mammalian, and primate-human stages, and leaving us with, to me, it kind of feels like sometimes a little inner lizard, an inner mouse, and an inner monkey, you know, related to those stages of brain evolution. And the most ancient part of the brain, that little inner lizard, is really scared because rule one in the wild was eat lunch today, don't be lunch today. You know, it's haunting to me and compassion-inducing to appreciate that most animals die in the moment of being eaten by another animal. So in that context, I think it's really powerful to recognize the power of fear, which is very easily manipulated. Obviously, you know, fear tends to trump hope in the political arena, and people can be very manipulated when they're led to believe that it's always threat level orange, et cetera, et cetera. In terms of personal life, two takeaways for me about this have been, one, to recognize just the power of fear in my own life and to realize that most of the time my sense of anxiety is a false alarm. That actually so-called signal anxiety, telling us there's something to be worried about, is just noise. There's no signal there. We have a kind of paper tiger paranoia that we evolved to have. So I've tried to help myself internalize experiences that target the fear systems in the brain. They're kind of the antidote experiences for that particular system, such as feeling strong inside or relaxing or recognizing that I'm actually all right in this moment. I may not have been all right in the past or the future, but I'm in this moment okay. And a sense of protection by other people. The other thing is I've gotten more aware of, honestly, how I scare other people needlessly. You know, what's it like for them to be with me, educated, white, professional, you know, middle-aged guy? And to realize that there are lots of little things we can do in families, especially with children, and in our intimate relationships, where without walking on eggshells, we don't have to give people causes to fear us. We can give them cause to expect no dessert if they don't eat their broccoli or something, but we don't need to give them cause to fear us.
Well, I will be sure when we meet face to face that I will eat my broccoli, Richard.
I don't care for it. I'm with the first George Bush. I don't care for broccoli myself.
Let's go back to the phones. We've got Ann on the line. Hi, Ann.
thanks very much for taking my call, and sure. I really appreciate this thoughtful and important discussion. My question has to do with how does one, or how do I, stop the negative scripts that keep running through my brain and the brains of those in my family. I come from a long line of people with depressive personalities. I think my mother and my dad were both born during the Depression. And so there was constantly that fear and that anxiety. And I've been working, I listened to Alice, I've been working in development work in critical priority countries in Afghanistan, Pakistan, and Iraq on and off for the last 9.5 years. And I know I've been doing good work, but I constantly have this negative script, despite the fact that I have a loving husband and 4 wonderful children. So any tools you can give me and my family would be greatly appreciated.
Sure. Well, should I dive in there, Dan? Or?
Yeah, you first.
Okay, no worries. Well, first, and you know, I honor you for your work. I mean, straight up. And there's a general model in healthcare, Dan knows it, that basically as our challenges and vulnerabilities rise, so must our resources. So if we do development work or peace work on a large scale, or just we're dealing with something challenging in our own life, it's important to build up the resources, you know, including taking in the good repeatedly, and like Dan said a little while ago, self-compassion, among other things, so that we can deal with these hard things. So that's just a general point one. Point two, about negative scripts.
Right.
For me, it's. I think there are basically just 3 ways to engage the mind, fundamentally, and this little framework has been very useful to me. First way is we simply observe what's there. We're mindful of it. We feel the feelings. We experience the experience. For example, we might explore the negative scripts. We might try to unpack them, deconstruct them in a sense, tease apart the threads. We might feel down to what's younger, more vulnerable. We don't try to change it. We just observe it. That's an incredibly important part of dealing with something, and that alone involves a kind of disidentifying from it, not taking it so personally, as we were talking about earlier,
observing it from a distance. It's the driver's seat thing.
Yeah,
right?
That's exactly right. That's exactly right. So, yeah, well, I think of it as like a movie, getting out of the movie, stepping back, just observing ego, just watching it. Okay, that's the first way. The second is we reduce the negative. That's the second way to engage the mind. We try to, for example, challenge the thoughts in the scripts, the beliefs that are embedded in them, or maybe there are sensations in the body or emotions that are linked to the scripts. We try to release those, you know, pulling weeds, as it were, in the garden of the mind. And then the third way to engage the mind is to grow flowers, is to build up resources inside, for example, that are particularly the opposite of the scripts. So I might ask myself, having done the first 2 steps, you know, observing the script and then trying to release it, okay, what would be a targeted, in effect, antidote? Like, what is this whole script about? If the script's about, let's suppose, feelings of inadequacy, then I would look for opportunities to take in legitimate, authentic, not pie in the sky, authentic experiences of worth, of accomplishment, of feeling valued by others. Or maybe the script, just to finish up here, has feelings in it of being abandoned or unloved, you know, left out. So then I would look for legitimate opportunities. You know, again, ones and twos on the 0 to 10 intensity scale most of the time, but still real opportunities to take in feelings of being seen, included, wanted, and loved. And gradually over time, I think that people actually can feel increasingly less haunted, as it were, by those scripts rattling around in the head. And eventually, as it were, flowers can crowd out weeds.
So we'll do. And if if you can tolerate it, we'll do a tag team thing here with you.
Please.
So, Anna, you've got those negative scripts, and I've got chronic severe pain. And some days it's awful, some days it's not so bad. But, I've learned about my pain, and my pain is like your negative script, right? It's not there 100% of the time. But when it comes, it's just awful. Yes? Okay, I guess you're off there. But when it comes, it's just awful. So here's what I do with my pain now when it's back. You know, when it hurts like hell, and I just say, that's pain. No storyline. That's pain. My pain is back. I don't like it. It's almost like when an annoying relative shows up at your door. You know, you don't like them. You don't know how long they're going to stay. And you don't know when they're going to leave, but you know they're going to leave. So it's, oh, crap. Here it is again. Let's hope it doesn't stay long. And that's also a way of disidentifying from it. Now, Rick, you take the next step and begin to challenge it and build in tools to modify it, to actually change the depressive thoughts. But I think it's just critical to get those thoughts out of the driver's seat. You know, I
totally agree, and I love your metaphor.
And you're the neuropsychologist. We don't even know what thoughts are.
That's right. Well, two things. First, studies do show that simply just doing what you said, noting it, you know, and in meditative practice, sometimes that's called a noting practice, where you just say pain, ache, burning, mm-hmm. or in terms of negative script, say sorrow, fear, inadequacy, longing, whatever it is. Just that act, simply labeling it without trying to change it, actually increases activation in the prefrontal cortex right behind the forehead, which is where the kind of executive systems of the brain, the perspective-making systems are located. And then also, just noting it calms down the alarm bell of the brain, the amygdala. So that's pretty good. And then the second thing I just wanted to say is that what you described there was, I think, a wonderful example of the first way to engage the mind, simply witnessing it. On the other hand, I think also, as you'd agree, you know, as someone I've been in psychology quite a long time now, and I'm also very aware of how the mindfulness-based interventions have moved in, including sometimes more Eastern approaches. I think they're really valuable, but I think clearly mindfulness alone is not enough.
Right.
Simply witnessing the mind, which means basically observing the workings of the brain, that's not enough.
Right.
You know, these tendencies in the brain, they're wired in, and the brain, because of its negativity bias, is resistant to pulling weeds, right? And the garden of the brain, as it were, is also fairly stony for flowers because of its negativity bias. So to me, we need to be not just mindfully observant, witnessing of the brain, of the mind, but we also need to pull weeds and plant flowers and engage wise effort as well.
And I like what you said. There really is an order to this process. Those three steps, and they have to be in that order. Let's go back to the phones. We've got Eileen on the line. Hi, Eileen.
Hi. I would like to go to a previous point that said you were talking about a few minutes ago, fear and anxiety is in the home. And my thought is when talking with my siblings, I have found out over the years that they feared my father. Now, my thought was, if I didn't do anything wrong, if he addressed me on something, or, you know, I had something to say, I would say it. So my question is really to, I don't know if it's Dr. or Mr. Hansen, would be, doesn't the person on the other end, in other words, the child or the wife or whomever is dealing with the person who's feared, doesn't that play a part in it? Doesn't their personality or, you know,
well,
how they interpret things play a part in it?
Rick, I want you to address Eileen directly, but this does get to the issue of childhood trauma or stressors.
Right, exactly. The first thing is that, as Dan well knows, the model that's really predominant in psychology is this idea of interaction. In other words, our own natural temperament or characteristics interact with our environment. So, for example, one child in a family might be particularly sensitive to feeling criticized. We have two young adult kids, and I can tell you without telling you which one it is, one of them is very sensitive to any kind of sense of scolding or displeasure. I learned painfully early on as a dad that a look was all it took, you know, whereas the other child was much more, you know, kind of like a duck, you know, water just sort of rolled off that child's back. And so that's part one. You, Eileen, may have had a particularly resilient temperament, which is great. The second thing is that, you know, research on families have shown that family experiences, as it were, are not all alike for all members of the family, that actually there are meaningful differences in the ways that, different children are raised, and that has an effect. And then the last thought I have about it is that at the end of the day, particularly as adults, there's this two-part process where both we face whatever happened to us and its effects upon us. I myself was never abused as a child. There were things about my childhood that were rocky and difficult that are small potatoes compared to what many people experienced, but they still affected me. And for every one person I've known, I come from California, so I've known a few, for every one person I've known who moans and groans way too much about their childhood, there are probably 10 or even 100 who actually underestimate its impact and are hard on themselves about it rather than, as Dan said earlier, being self-compassionate. So to me, part one is to recognize what really did happen and to have some sense of the truth of it, you know, having a realistic perspective, neither pessimistic nor optimistic. But then second, hey, what are we going to do about it? And it's on us as we face life, especially as adults, to do what we can, you know, to recover from our childhoods, whatever they were, including your siblings, Eileen, and to grow inside, to heal, you know, to move on. It doesn't mean that we let those other people off the hook necessarily, but we also need to heal and grow ourselves. As they say in Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, resentment can be like taking poison and then waiting for others to die.
Hmm. I love that. Eileen, I hope that was helpful for you. I interviewed a rabbi who wrote When Bad Things Happen to Good People.
Oh, really? Yeah.
He talked about resentment, and he said resentment is like mud wrestling with a pig. He said you'll both get dirty, but the pig's going to like it.
Oh, gosh.
That's
a great metaphor.
When we've got to take our break. When we come back, we've got a caller who wants to challenge this whole concept of happiness as being perhaps overblown. We're talking with neuropsychologist Rick Hansen, and his new book is called Hardwiring Happiness, The New Brain Science of Contentment, Calm, and Confidence. It's a wonderful book, and it's filled with practical things we can do to actually make ourselves feel better about our lives and the world around us. Our number is 888-477-9499. I'm Dan Gottlieb. You're listening to Voices in the Family right here on WHYY-FM. We're back on Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb. We're talking with neuropsychologist Rick Hansen about how the brain is wired. Let's go right to the phones. We've got Mohammed on the line. Hi, Mohammed.
Yeah, hi, Dan. I am a physician. I'm from Iraq. I lived in Iraq, and I lived in this country, too. And I study a lot of psychology. I'm an inventor, too. And I found out, you know, during my studies that really happiness is a myth. Perpetrated by people who either don't understand this world or they are fooling themselves, because there is occasional happiness, which is, you know, if you accomplish something that you're expecting and you don't expect. But otherwise, happiness is really unattainable. Why? Because first, there's the fear of death, and that lurks everywhere, every time in our minds. Second, the meaning of life. Why are we on this earth? What is expected of us? So if you are expecting really happiness, you're fooling yourself, or you're not aware what is happening in the world.
Well, I think your point is interesting, and it really is relevant. You know, I want to refer you back, Mohammed, to Dan Gilbert. If you haven't read his book, it's called Stumbling on Happiness. And
yes, I did.
All right. So he says, we don't even know what it is. You know, you eat you eat ice cream, you're happy. Well, I'm happy. Your child gets married, you're happy, but they're two very different experiences. On the other hand, when you feel love, that's a whole other experience, so we don't even know what it is. So I'm going to turn to you, Rick. And you know, who is it that said the pursuit of happiness is sure to make us miserable?
Well, I think first it depends a bit on what we mean by the word happiness. And in the field of research here, happiness tends to mean two kinds of things. One, experiences that are in the moment feel positive, a sense of accomplishment, feeling loved by someone, or maybe a recognition of some good quality in oneself. And the second meaning of happiness is more of a broader notion of fulfillment, of service, of meaning and purpose, of contribution in life. Eudaimonia is the fancy term that was coined for this. So both of those are different kinds of happiness. I use the term myself, as I said in the beginning of the show, happiness quite broadly to include well-being, resilience, you know, feeling secure and adequate rather than insecure and inadequate and so forth. That said, I would actually, I think, disagree with respect with Muhammad. I think there's much evidence that people can increase their general set point for happiness in the broad sense that I'm using it here to include both everyday experiences of well-being as well as more profound aspects of fulfillment and meaning and purpose in life. People really can increase that because they can literally change their brain, which is a physical system that's the substrate of that kind of happiness. Now, it's also true that alongside these forms of happiness, broadly defined, are many unpleasant experiences, losses, disabilities, injuries, difficult conditions, wars, poverty, and all the rest of that. But the one does not take away from the other. If we expand our view to see the whole mosaic of reality, not just to include the good tiles or the positive tiles, if you will, the negative tiles and the neutral tiles, we can see the whole picture. You know, I have a background, as I said, in Buddhist psychology. You know, the first noble truth, as I bet Muhammad well knows, is, you know, in Buddhism, is the noble truth of suffering. There is suffering. But it doesn't mean there's only suffering. There's also happiness, broadly defined. And it's actually happiness, broadly defined, that I'm talking about here, including the very powerful, beneficial physical health effects of positive emotions that can help us become more capable of dealing with both our own personal suffering as well as the hard conditions out there in the world. So again, it's not either or. I think it's a false dichotomy here. But I think there's an enormous body of evidence at this point for the positive effects of happiness broadly defined, particularly when we internalize it and we take it into ourselves and grow as a result.
Do Muhammad, do we still have you on the line? Yes.
Well, see, I lived in Iraq, and with all the wars and the poverty and all that, sometimes I was happier there occasionally more than I, you know, experienced it here in this country where you're better off. So, that, I mean, you tell yourself that you're happy, but what is it, a true happiness? I mean, if you're going to die soon or even in a few years, then you don't know what's going to happen in the other life, if there is another life.
Well, let me share something with you, Muhammad, and I want to challenge something that you're saying about, you know, fear of death and happiness, and they can go hand in hand. As you know or may know, you know, I've been a quadriplegic for 33 years, and I have been close to death many times, and now I'm 67 years old, and I don't know how much more time I have. I do know this, Muhammad. I've got much less time than I want to have. I know that. And it's almost like, you know, Sartre said you should live with death on your shoulder, and I do. I hear that clock. But when I do that, I have life on my other shoulder. And the more I hear that clock, the more grateful I am for watching nature, for the love I have around me, for the beauty of life itself. It's not either or that when you hear that clock ticking, everything becomes more vivid.
Right. If I could build on that, Dan, you know, to Muhammad's point about being happier at different times in Iraq, let's say, in a war zone, let's say, than in a, you know, more comfortable life, it goes to the point that you're getting at as well, which is that if we make our happiness, broadly defined again, dependent upon our external conditions, well, then that's a sure prescription for disaster. On the other hand, if people make an effort to grow inner strengths of various kinds, including a positive mood, then increasingly their well-being, their coping, their effectiveness, their spiritual fulfillment even, is increasingly unconditional. It's not based upon external conditions increasingly. It's more and more inside themselves. They take it with themselves wherever they go. And I think that's really the long-run benefit of gradually weaving these things into yourself.
Muhammad, I want to thank you so much for your call. And you know, it was provocative, and I appreciate what it brings out. Rick, mm-hmm. you and neurologist Rick Mendius, did I pronounce that right?
Mm-hmm.
You founded a nonprofit called the Wellspring Institute for Neuroscience and Contemplative Wisdom. And I bring this up because you just mentioned spirituality. So when I looked at the activities of this institute, there's a good deal there about spiritual growth and not privileging science over spiritual wisdom and vice versa. You even sponsored an interfaith conference entitled "This Is Your Brain on God." Tell us about that.
Oh, very interesting. Well, you know, I love science. I'm deeply rooted in it, and my dad's a zoologist, retired professor, and all the rest of that. I'm a geek. I have deep geek roots, whatever. But the way I look at it is that if you think of three circles, brain science, psychology, contemplative wisdom, from all the world's traditions, Western, Eastern, and secular traditions of contemplative practice, at the center of those three circles, I think, is a lot of value. There are validity checks there, and there are cross-pollinations where different domains, like neuroscience interacting with meditation, for example, or meditation interacting with mindfulness-based therapies that are now developing mm-hmm. more and more in psychology, including to prevent relapse and depression. That's to me a very juicy territory, and our institute is quite small, and we're low overhead, right? One thing we've done recently, by the way, is sponsor a study that I did on a course I created on taking the good with collaborators from the University of California, and we're writing up the findings, but the preliminary, you know, not yet peer-reviewed results, are that by learning to take in the good, people can become increasingly happy, loving, self-compassionate, to that earlier, as well as grateful, and develop more kinds of self-control, too. So that's a pretty good result that's come out of some of the work of the Institute.
And, you know, you mentioned loving, and we've only got a little bit of time left, but, you know, we're talking about rewiring brains and developing new habitual experiences. And I know you've got an exercise in your book for this, but loving is also habitual. So that the more we love, the easier it is to love. The more we
Isn't
love,
that profoundly wonderful?
The more we love, the more we love, the less afraid we are of loving, of being hurt or abandoned. Just love begets love.
Yeah, love is love flowing in or flowing out. It's remarkable. I'm a longtime therapist like you, Dan. And, you know, people sometimes are afraid that if they're loving, they'll become depleted. But actually, being loving is very fueling. You know, it fills us up. It's replenishing. It tops off our tanks. And I think that's incredibly remarkable. And, again, a lot of studies show that as people do compassion practices or kindness practices or patience, forbearance, forgiveness practices, they actually change their brain in really positive ways.
And I think in Sanskrit, the phrase for listening to that is, that's way cool.
Well, and, you know, the old line of what the world needs now is love. And
yeah.
I think it's hard to be loving when you feel like you're running on empty, you know,
no,
when
you're not kidding. Sadly, Richard, we are out of time and we have to go. I want to thank you so much. This has been a great show and great fun hanging out with you this week.
Oh, ditto as well. Much respect to you, Dan. Thank you.
You too, Rick. Next week on Voices in the Family, looking inside the boarding homes that serve the mentally ill and needy. Well, check us out. We're at whyy.org/voices. We're at Twitter at Voices in the Fam. I am at drdangottlieb.com. And check out. I've got some really interesting lectures going on there and some activities. So check out my webpage. Well, the engineer for today's show has been Mr. Al Banks. Thank you, Al. Elizabeth Perez-Luner is our executive producer of audio content. Emily Haas is our production assistant. Mike and Scott is our executive producer. Jennifer Lynn is our producer. Hats off to Jennifer. Oh, me. I'm Dan Gottlieb. Hey, enjoy your week, my friends.